From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Facebook's top two executives, Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, this week held a meeting with the organizers of a powerful new boycott campaign against the social media platform. Leaders of the campaign, called Stop Hate for Profit, say they were unimpressed by the executives' justifications for why their highly profitable corporation has taken so few steps to curb the flowering of racism on it. They said Zuckerberg and Sandberg engaged in, quote, spin, and fired up their, quote, powerful PR machine. Facebook faces a serious advertising boycott from some of its biggest customers as a result of the campaign. But Mr. Zuckerberg says he thinks the boycott will end soon enough. Among the accusations he faces are the deliberate enabling of hate and racism perpetuated by President Donald Trump and his followers. The newly revealed results of a two-year-long audit confirm that Facebook has fostered attacks on civil rights. My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan. He's a professor of information studies and design media arts at UCLA. His books include Who's Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World, and After the Internet, and Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. He's a frequent guest on our program on these issues. Welcome back, Ramesh.
Hi, Sonali. Thank you for having me today.
So it seems as though this particular campaign, the Stop Hate for Profit campaign, has had more success in trying to hold Facebook accountable than perhaps any other effort so far. Facebook is a behemoth. It is one of the most profitable corporations on the planet. And now this campaign has succeeded in getting quite a large number of big advertisers from withholding their business. And advertising is how Facebook makes its money. How significant is this in your view?
It's extremely significant because the instruments of power by which Facebook is sort of carried, in a sense, are its advertisers. It is a for-profit business. It is dependent on its corporate valuation, and it's dependent on its profitability. And all of that, all of those resources come from investors and advertisers. So it's we're witnessing just an incredible moment, as Cornel West calls it, a moment of reckoning, a time of reckoning, where these profoundly powerful protests, these incredibly democratic experiments we're seeing all over the country of people standing up for civil rights, for Black lives, are now aligning, or at the minimum, various kind of corporations and advertisers are recognizing that they have no choice but to sort of at least tacitly go along with the sort of wave of messaging that is part and central to these protests. So as a result of this, we are seeing Facebook having to actually shake in its boots here, because the advertisers themselves are recognizing that Facebook is a platform upon which inflammatory and hateful content not only spreads, but in a sense, the platform is designed to actually proliferate that type of content, as we've talked about for years, actually.
Yeah. Earlier this week, Associated Press reported that a loose network of Facebook groups that took root across the country in April to organize protests against the lockdowns, the COVID lockdowns, these right-wing pro-Trump protests, have now pivoted to a variety of new targets, including Black Lives Matter and the nationwide protests of racial injustice. They've, some of them just changed their name. One was called Reopen California. They changed their name to California Patriots Pro Law and Order. And so clearly this is a platform that has been quite useful for these small but highly vocal groups to spread their hate. And then you see the memes that they proliferate, many of which are flat out false and or hateful and or racist, proliferate, get shared without question. I have pro-Trump relatives who in person are perfectly nice people who share some of these images and some of these false narratives that foment hate from these groups. And so it's pretty clear that Facebook is enabling this. But how do they make money from these sorts of organizations directly? I mean, are they, is it just that they're, the more eyeballs there are on Facebook, the more advertisers will pay Facebook?
Yeah, it's a great question, Sonali. Facebook makes money in two very clear ways. One is, as you just stated, whatever content is predicted to gather more attention, to get, you know, to grab people's eyeballs, as you said, is likely the content that serves Facebook's purposes, because all of us as human beings are often in a stunned and dismayed way. We are attracted, not in a positive sense, but we can't help but notice hateful content, inflammatory content, and so on. And that kind of content works very well for Facebook because it proliferates widely. People spread it, people pay attention to it, people comment upon it, even simply to criticize it or to rebuke it, right? So that kind of inflammatory content has always been sort of, in a sense, a secret ingredient that actually allows Facebook to function as it does, as the major platform by which inflammatory and disinformation go viral. However, the other component of this is the micro-targeting component. So the more sort of niche communities, the more sort of kind of parceling specific kinds of messaging that goes viral on Facebook, that is available on Facebook, the more you can understand who is aligned and has what perspectives with some of this sort of, I would say, inflammatory content, then the more you can micro-target them with specific forms of advertising. And that micro-targeting is really central to Facebook's business model.
I want to talk about Donald Trump. The committee to re-elect Trump within the past few weeks posted an ad, which is really symbolic of the ads they've posted in general. This particular one went so far as to use a symbol that the Nazis used to describe Jews, an upside down red triangle, political prisoners is, you know, what they designated people with the symbol. And next to the symbol, the Trump committee wrote, "Dangerous mobs of far-left groups are running through our streets and causing absolute mayhem. They are destroying our cities and rioting. It's absolute madness." He specifically singled out Antifa. This is all code for multiracial protesters and or black protesters or black-led protests. Facebook, I suppose at this moment, the line was crossed for Facebook, and after pressure, they asked the committee to take the campaign to take it down. But specifically, how do you see the relationship between Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg and Donald Trump?
It's a very symbiotic relationship. I mean, Facebook is one of the sponsors of the Republican National Convention. Brad Parscale, who's Trump's campaign manager this round, was Trump's chief digital strategist in 2016. He has said on the record multiple times that Facebook was their secret sauce for micro-targeting, dividing and conquering, riling up the base, and getting enough people to get out there and vote based on their fears and anxieties to barely push Trump over the top with the Electoral College in 2016. It's really no different this time in 2020, because Facebook has never made any meaningful concessions. In fact, Facebook tends to operate, and Mark Zuckerberg is quite clear, if not brazen, about this, that Facebook tends to operate kind of claiming that they are just the platform for all forms of free speech. So they sort of rhetorically invoke the First Amendment and free speech as if somehow free speech exists in a vacuum in the United States, that certain forms of free speech, so-called free speech by the powerful, can actually become hate speech, which can then turn into hate crimes. So Zuckerberg has found a model of inflammatory content, kind of divide and conquer with these micro-targeting algorithms, with all of us living in our own kind of ecosystems, echo chambers, you know, and so on Facebook, that has made this company incredibly successful. One of the wealthiest and most powerful companies in the history of the world, not just in the United States, but the vast majority of users, as I've talked about in Beyond the Valley, are across the global South. And that's why we've seen hateful content with hateful politicians work perfectly and symbiotically with Facebook all over the world. And Brad Parscale is quite clear, Trump's campaign manager, Facebook is going to be their vehicle to try to activate their base and barely push him over the top as we head toward the November election.
In late June, Washington Post reported that Mark Zuckerberg once wanted to sanction Trump. Then Facebook wrote rules that accommodated him. As early as 2015, Facebook executives started crafting exceptions for the then candidate. And it's really interesting because Facebook does have, you know, so-called community standards. The rest of us are held to those standards. In fact, I have one friend who's a Facebook friend who's a professor in Southern California who has just been banned by Facebook for using expletives to denounce the dictators of Egypt and Trump as well. And, in you know, using colorful language. And he was just banned from Facebook briefly or suspended. And this is something that Twitter and Jack Dorsey, who leads Twitter, has also been guilty of, although Twitter has been a little bit more responsive in recent days, that the same standards that the rest of us get applied to somehow don't apply to the person with the biggest bullhorn, the person who should be held perhaps to the highest standard, which is the president of the country, because they're claiming, what Twitter claims, that his words are newsworthy, and so people should hear them. Facebook simply just says free speech.
Everything goes. Basically, everything goes. Absolutely.
Everything goes, but just for Trump, not for us.
Absolutely. In a very asymmetric way, because the market logic, the business logic, the computational logic by which Facebook operates works exactly with the kind of political ecosystem we have, where those who are most powerful in many cases in our society have been able to obtain that power and in a strange way consolidate that power through hateful speech that works exactly well, strange bedfellows, with these technology platforms and the algorithms that allow that content to disseminate. So Trump saying hateful content, stating hateful content around, you know, in around the guise of free speech is actually exactly what Facebook wants and needs to actually work very systemically and symbiotically with Trump himself. So technologies almost always are a reflection of these political systems of various times. And that's why Trump has actually quite brazenly described himself as the social media president. And he actually often praises Facebook as his mechanism of reaching the people directly. But he's not actually reaching us. What he's doing is working with Facebook's, you know, policies and lack of accountability to actually reach us, but in this micro-targeted divide and conquer way, where, you know, I could speak even in a defiant tone about Trump on Facebook, but Facebook will probably adjudicate me as not being necessarily worthy of spreading my content, not just because of the content I put out, but because of my power already in the world. So mm-hmm. If you're powerful and can put out hateful content, you're perfect for Facebook spreading your content. And that's what we've seen all over the world, as you alluded to. We've seen that with Rodrigo Duterte. We've seen that with Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. We've seen that with Viktor Orban in Hungary. This works very, very well. And this is something that needs to be intervened within right now. And that has to be done through public audit, public governance, and public accountability. Remember, Facebook lives off of an internet that was publicly funded by American taxpayers.
Right. And there is quite a cozy relationship between Zuckerberg and Trump in late May after Twitter started posting warning labels on Trump's tweets. Trump had a personal phone call directly with Mark Zuckerberg that was reported on in the press. Facebook's own employees are really upset by, you know, the fact that they seem to be part of this company that is enabling such hate to proliferate. Many of them have begun speaking out, have engaged in walkouts, have engaged in, you know, calling attention to their boss. Some of them have actually resigned. So how effective could this advertiser boycott be now? Zuckerberg seems to be dismissing it. I think he thinks that that his company is too big to fail and that he's going to be able to ride out this storm.
It seems that way. However, we've had wave after wave of controversy, wave after wave of embarrassment for Facebook, really before the 2016 election, but definitely since and during it. The advertisers deciding to pull funding from Facebook, at least temporarily, I believe is a significant warning sign to Facebook in a way that nothing else has been, certainly not people like ourselves, you know, independent media scholars like myself criticizing Facebook they couldn't, it doesn't seem like they could care less about that. I think employees walking out, as we saw what happened with the so-called virtual boycott with Facebook a couple weeks ago, does have some meaning. It's bad PR for Facebook, but advertisers, you know, this is really being created and caused by these protests. I think that's just a wave of real optimism that I feel. Without these protests and without public sentiment in the United States completely shifting in a remarkable way, this is something Noam Chomsky has spoken about actually just very recently. Public sentiment has now aligned with these protests, with the cause of Black lives, with the cause of compassion, with the cause of justice, right? That is public sentiment. And these advertisers who are basically, you know, at the end of the day, just thinking about their own bottom line in many cases, realize that they better synchronize with this wave. And they realize that Facebook is not going to do anything about this because Facebook is tethered to a very successful business model that does promote hateful and conspiracy-oriented content. So we'll see how long. We have to pressure these advertisers to continue to stay off of Facebook. And we'll see what kinds of concessions and actually and changes might come Facebook's way, because now is the time of reckoning when it comes to Facebook.
The campaign is called Stop Hate for Profit, and it can be found online. And it is the brainchild of a number of organizations, including Color of Change, Common Sense Media, Free Press, the NAACP, the Anti-Defamation League, the National Hispanic Media Coalition, LULAC, Mozilla, and others. And they're pretty clear. They basically said that Facebook makes $70 billion a year through advertising, and they could support and protect Black users. They could call out Holocaust denial as hate. They could help get out the vote, but they're actively choosing not to do any of these things. And they're asking, your profits are basically promoting hate, bigotry, racism, anti-Semitism, and violence. And so a number of corporations have actually joined in, some of them very big corporations, some not so big. And you know, it certainly remains to be seen how long this campaign will go on. But this seems to also be something that, you know, I'm wondering if you think it would be beautiful irony for Facebook users to spread this campaign on Facebook to encourage advertisers who haven't yet come on board to boycott.
I think we should all do that, to be completely honest. And it is sort of beautifully ironic. I like that way of looking at it. And I just want to make the point, and this is what I was about to say earlier. Mm-hmm. It's not simply the advertising revenue by which Facebook is so powerful. It's the fact that they have been able to collect such intimate behavioral and micro-targeting oriented data, right, about various individuals, right? So they can make predictions about political viewpoints, about psychological predispositions, about behavioral perspectives, and so on, about all of us on a very intimate, parceled and fragmented level. And that is a huge part of why Facebook's valuation cannot seem, which is, you know, about $1 trillion, kind of goes up and down a little bit. That's why Facebook cannot be understood simply through its advertising revenue, but its largesse of intimate, behaviorally manipulative data. And also just remember, as we've talked about before, Sonali, Facebook owns Instagram, Facebook owns WhatsApp. These are all sorts of other platforms upon which all sorts of, you know, hateful content has spread, micro-targeted content has spread. You know, I mean, we're both South Asian, Sonali. Like, I'm on WhatsApp groups with some of my relatives in India, and there's all this sort of conspiracy theory, anti-Muslim.
Oh, yes, I've seen that, yep.
God help us, you know, and that just stays in this closed group. And it's with cousins and relatives and so on. So when you start seeing this content proliferate amongst people who you claim think are of as dear to you on a WhatsApp group, you think of it as reality and as truth. And we have seen that not just be a problem on a technological level, but have real world disastrous effects. For example, the violence against Muslim people in Sri Lanka that was created by Facebook rumors of, you know, against the Muslim minority there.
Wow. So the advertising revenue, the micro-targeting, all of that, none of that is actually central to Facebook simply continuing to operate, right? It's a platform that brings people together. If all they cared about was the First Amendment and free speech and proliferating truth, they could give up all the micro-targeting, stop using the algorithms that tries to maximize, you know, profits and curates what individual users see. They could simply allow users to actually control their own feeds better and actually choose how they want to engage with one another simply using Facebook as a platform. But a lot of the rhetoric around free speech obscures the true agenda, which is $70 billion a year in advertising revenue that has catapulted people like Zuckerberg and Sandberg into the height of riches. And it's pretty remarkable considering that so much of what Facebook helps to spread is anti-Semitism, that these two Jewish American executives are participating in enabling. And perhaps that's why the ADL is also part of this campaign targeting Facebook.
It's really remarkable. I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's important to note that also pressure should be put on investors of Facebook, not just advertisers, but investors of Facebook.
Yeah.
Because they should, you know, just like we have to boycott investments, you know, like our use of banks like Chase who have invested in, you know.
So a divestment campaign.
Yeah. Divestment campaign. And these investors, and this is a very troubling point, Sonali, but even if the investors had all come together with Facebook to say, hey, we don't want Mark Zuckerberg, we don't want Sheryl Sandberg, because of the dual class share structure by which Zuckerberg has a special class of shares in terms of equity of Facebook, he actually cannot be kicked out of Facebook. It's actually easier, believe it or not, for us to remove Donald Trump, we all hope and pray, than to remove Mark Zuckerberg. So a so-called traded company, even the investors don't have total power over the removal of this leader who is not leading.
So an unelected, an unaccountable person who, as per the audit that I mentioned, a two-year-long audit, has literally set back the progress on civil rights in this country through his enabling of hate on his platform. Pretty remarkable to see all of that in full view and all of these things coming to our head now. Well, we'll see how everything plays out. Of course, we have an election here in just a few months, which through Facebook, we're already seeing manipulation of voters. And, you know, 4 years ago, this was the same conversation. Perhaps the 2016 election might have been the first big reality check for people who hadn't thought to critique Facebook, that it plays such an outsized role in our democracy, in our political systems. Here we are 4 years later, and very little has actually changed. And Trump's influence and the influence of his base over Facebook and using Facebook seems to have only increased.
They're doubling down on Facebook. I mean, Facebook's their vehicle to try to deliver this election. I think that that Trump's, you know, clear, in the most benign way I can describe his behavior as tone deaf in relation to these protests all around us. But Mark Zuckerberg's tone deafness at this time is pretty remarkable as well. And, it's a strange moment we live within, Sonali, where those who claim to connect us are actually deeply disconnected from the causes of their users and all of us as citizens.
They're disconnected
from Black Lives in that sense. They're disconnected from Black Lives and the cause of Black Lives that we all are fighting for. And we won't stop fighting for.
I suppose that these companies are worried about government regulations. And so a big part of their enabling of some of these figures and actors is to ensure that a political climate doesn't flower that ends up restricting their ability to make money, right? Because, I mean, if Zuckerberg can't be removed even by his own shareholders tomorrow, he could literally ban Trump just Trump even. Twitter could ban, just Trump from their platforms. And there's nothing that Trump could actually do about that to those figures directly. However, if Trump is reelected or future presidents could create a scenario where they regulate and come down on these companies. So it's almost as though these companies are hedging their bets for a regulatory, favorable regulatory scenario.
That's right, because, you know, we've seen some concessions. I would say they're more like window dressing than anything by companies like Twitter, which said, hey, at least we're gonna label these tweets as potentially hateful and not factual and kind of provide context behind them. Trump called that a violation of his free speech, but there's like, you know, Twitter putting in its free speech in relation to Trump's hate speech is not a violation of anyone's free speech, right? So we've seen some of these concessions, or Trump, or Twitter also, and I would say in a somewhat disingenuous way, saying, hey, we won't run any political ads any longer. But that's not Twitter's business model. That's Facebook's business model. So, you know, we really have to scrutinize the workings of each of these companies in a very specific way and understand their business models and recognize that they are private companies that use public language. They rest upon our public, you know, as users, our public as our personal data, and publicly funded internet investments and National Science Foundation funding, really. So what has to occur, and I've called for this many times, a so-called digital bill of rights that really balances and forces these tech companies to recognize that they have to serve the public interest as well as their own business interests. And there is no balance at this point, and we have to force that issue and ensure that that occurs. And that's exactly what I was trying to do in my limited role with Senator Sanders' campaign.
That's right. Yeah. Well, Ramesh, I want to thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Always love having you on. Thanks so much.
I love talking to you. Thank you for having me, Sonali.
Ramesh Srinivasan is Professor of Information Studies and Design Media Arts at UCLA. He's written a number of books, including Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. He's a frequent guest on our program. And we've been discussing the campaign against Facebook's enabling of racism and hate. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.